This interview is being conducted for Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium project number AN08-NJ7. The interviewer is Sarah Corbin. Aaron Isaacs is being interviewed on April 20th, 2012 at 12 o'clock in the afternoon. The interview is being conducted at Aaron's home in Klawock. Thank you for meeting with me, Aaron. It's a pleasure to meet you. Can you please start with telling me about how long you have resided in Klawock?
I was born and raised here in Klawock. In fact, born and raised on this very spot. And this is where our house was when I was growing up. The house burned down about 1959 or 60. And as it turns out now, five generations of Isaacs have lived on this property. But growing up here in the 40s, and again, the main topic of the interview, I guess, would be in regard to the Bayview Boulevard. I remember when Bayview Boulevard was a boardwalk. And I remember so many things about what I started to tell you before we started the interview was how we had literally divided up this Bayview Boulevard by sections. One section was, I guess you might say, under the authority of certain brothers up to a point, and then from here over to the next section was my brother and I. Reason for that was we would go underneath the boardwalk and collect money. Drunks, you stagger around, drop money, and go down through the cracks. And if you caught somebody in your section, you could literally beat them up. And it happened more than once. But that's just a side story of the boardwalks of Klawock, Bayview. But I remember when the boardwalks were being torn up and replaced. And I believe that came under the CCC, the Forest Service CCC projects. But even before that, though, I remember the Salvation Army, which was kind of halfway across to what we called the island at the time. And certain nights, certain Sunday nights, I imagine, their band would march through town playing music. But I remember that. It is always such a thrill to run down on a sidewalk and watch the band, Salvation Army band, going by. But I guess there's stories more than once where different band members had fallen through the boardwalk. It wasn't very deep, though. But there's stories of different ones having fallen through the boardwalk. And after the boardwalks were replaced, by then I was in grade school by then.
What were they replaced with?
Mud, dirt, dirt road. And the dirt roads was literally a one-lane road. Of course, there was no cars in Klawock, except for Al Woodmark had a pickup that he used for delivering groceries around and so on. And about 1946 or 47, my dad was working for the construction company. The first bridge was put in. And beyond that, the road used to end at mile 5. And I was told it is a Forest Service road. But I remember my grandfather, my Haida grandfather, walking up from Craig up to the end of the road by Black Sand Point, and he had a rowboat pulled up under the brush there. Then he'd row into Klawock. And after school, after the school was out, springtime, I remember going back with him, then we'd walk to Craig, and I'd stay by him during the summer months. And I believe it about 1947, when the road was completed into Klawock, then the bridge was put in. The first bridge was put in 47, 48. And the reason I remember it so vividly is my father fell through a plank and broke some ribs falling into his boat. And before that, he had a piece of cable hit him in the ear. But he had some serious injuries building the road and the bridge. But the bridge used to be a, what they called a drawbridge. This two-hand cranks, I guess, that lift up the middle section of the bridge to let a boat through. And I remember my uncle's boat having gone in through there one time, one or two times, the Louise Second. And 1960, I went away to school in Lawrence, Kansas after high school. And I went to a trade school in Lawrence, Kansas, BIA boarding school. And I believe it was 1959 when I came home, they were putting in the second bridge. My dad worked on that one also, my dad and my brother. And then a third bridge went in, and now this one. So there's been four bridges since the first one was put in. But the boardwalks, again, were, when that bridge was completed and the boardwalks were out, I remember the first car that came into Tlaloc. I still remember that. I was sitting on, we used to have a boardwalk going on the main road.
From the house?
Yeah. I was sitting on there, working on a little fishing hook. And I looked up by a busy corner store and I saw that, I'd never seen a car in my life. And I saw that car come around the corner, you know, and I jumped up and I started running across the lawn. And the end of my fishing line got caught on the boardwalk. And that little hook I was holding snagged me in the stomach, and I still have the scar here. Snagged me in the stomach, so I stopped very quick, pulled it out, and kept running. But I remember the car was George James's car from Craig. And I could almost remember that it being a green Buick. I remember seeing the car, and I was just absolutely amazed at the first car I'd ever seen in my life. And after that, more cars start coming into town. So that kind of gives you some idea, though, of the change from the boardwalks to dirt road, you know, for cars. And it was exciting. It was exciting times. And these are the 40s up into, well, it would have been the late 40s by the time the more cars start coming into Tlaloc. Pictures. I have pictures, slides that were taken by a minister that arrived here about 1943 or thereabout, Reverend Ross Cleland. And he must have started taking pictures the day he arrived in Tlaloc. And I have over 300 pictures in my collection that I got from him, pictures of old Tlaloc. A lot of the people, of course, are gone now. But I had it made into a video one time, and somebody borrowed it and never got it back. But I've got all the slides, though, that could be made into probably another video.
Would you be interested in having that happen?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I gave two or three of them to my son Leslie for the bell tower project that they're working on. But other than that, I've got them all there. I've got it on a carousel. Up until they left here in 1953, I believe it was. And we never heard anything from them. And we heard once, though, that the oldest son was playing basketball at the University of Arizona, or Arizona State, one of them, and never saw the family again. And my daughter was in college in Bellingham, and what happened was her cousin had bought a new Nissan, and she had taken it back to the dealer to have it checked and whatever, and my daughter left something in the car. So she drove my old Thunderbird that I gave her brother to retrieve her thing. She walked into the dealer, and this person she was talking to, she said, big, huge person. And first thing he said, is that your car out there? Tina said, well, yeah, I said, but it's my brother's car. And he says, you're from Alaska? Tina said, yeah. Where at? He said, oh, you wouldn't know. He said, try me. By then she was kind of getting irritated. And she said, oh, I'm from Tlaloc, Alaska. You're from Tlaloc? And by then she's really getting irritated. You're from Tlaloc? Tina said, yeah. Said, you know Aaron Isaacs? My daughter said, she almost fainted. She said, that's my dad. Here it is, Gene Cleland. He grew up right behind my house here with the his father was Presbyterian minister. Grew up with us. And quite honestly, he was the first white boy I had ever seen when I was a little kid. First time I ever saw a white boy. I just thought there was something wrong. Light skin. But Gene and I went on to become the dearest friend because we both served in the 82nd Airborne, paratroopers. And Gene and I call each other all the time. We visit each other. But that's the story of his father. His father was just a down-to-earth person, as well as his mother. His mother was, she'd been a nurse before, and when she married the minister, they came here. But I remember her at a lot of emergency situations. But the other thing that always impressed me about them was they dove right into our Indian food with us. It didn't bother them to eat Indian food with us. And that's pretty much the story of the Claylands. I still talk to them. Another brother is out in Hawaii. I converse with him quite often. I'm not weary. Gene and I were both, Gene, the big fella, him and I were both in the 82nd Airborne Division at the same time, but we didn't see each other because there are 16,000 of us paratroopers in the 82nd Airborne Division. But when we started comparing notes, we realized, shoot, we were both at Fort Bragg at the same time. Huh. And we're very proud of having served with the 82nd.
Can you tell me about how Tlaloc was settled?
Again, from what I read in my books, most of our people came from Texican, the Tlinidi Dog Salmon clan, and they would come here during the spring and summer months to collect salmon because of the salmon stream. And after the fishing season was over, working in the cannery, then they'd go back to Texican. But every year they came and went back, more and more people stayed here in Tlaloc, which eventually became a village, community, and so on. But that is how Tlaloc was.
Were they working at the cannery more and more?
That's what I've read. They're working in the canneries, yeah.
And which canneries would those have been that they were working at?
Well, the first cannery in Alaska had to be somewhere near where the bridge is now. Now, a lot of people say that the first cannery, oh, bull crap, you know. These young people that come from wherever, they try to think they know everything. Then there was a cannery across the bay there. You might see some remnants across there. A Libby cannery was across there. Mm. But I remember parts of it when I was growing up. And then Bob's cannery, you'll see parts of that along the shore. And then the existing cannery down there. Now, I read several, in fact, the Prince of Wales brochure. They're saying that, I could almost cite it, they said in 1934, Tlaloc got money for the can. That was not the case. That cannery down there, the existing cannery now, when I first started coming to, was a Bellingham cannery. Then it came a Libby cannery. Then it became a Tlaloc Oceanside Packing Company, Copco cannery. But I remember about 1946, 47 or thereabouts, when the community voted on whether to have alcohol liquor stores in Tlaloc or not have liquor stores. And if they voted against it, then the Bureau of Indian Affairs would give them money to buy the cannery. But if they voted for alcohol liquor in Tlaloc, and they didn't get the cannery. But I remember my mother and them talking about it. And again, remember I mentioned my parents being alcoholic. They voted against it. That's how that cannery became the IRA's cannery. And anybody can go back and research the history on it to know exactly when that cannery was purchased.
Yesterday, when I was looking at some of the historic photos with your son Leslie, and I had showed him one that I'd found in an old report, and we think that we have placed that first cannery on the point of, is it Chuck's Island, the little island?
Yeah, that's what I was saying.
And there's a little shack there right now, and I'll show you the photos in a moment. But we think that that looks like that first cannery site. You think
so? The reason
so?
I believe that is the only spot that's deep enough for boats to come in to unload.
How deep is the water there?
It's rather deep. I know I have a beach seine that goes down at least 10, 12 fathoms deep. And it's the big tides. You can go in there. I remember my uncle's boat, the Louis II, went through the bridge, drawbridge that I talked about, and there was plenty of water under there. But that's my guess too, is it is somewhere in that where the bridge area is now.
And is that where people would have first started settling Kilowog? Is that on the island in Chuck's Island?
Actually, no, not just that point there. When you look at any old pictures, you'll see where it stretches all the way down to the point. Down to Demers Point, totem poles and smoke houses all along the beach. So
people use this whole shoreline that's now Bayview Boulevard when they were first coming in for the cannery work. So this picture we're looking at now is from a 1899 report on the salmon fisheries in Alaska, and it is a picture of Kilowog.
Those aren't pictures of Kilowog, though.
It says view of Kilowog looking west.
Looking west.
So what Leslie and I were thinking when we were looking at this picture and one that he has, it's a very similar view, is that this is where it's standing over where the road is as you go around towards the airport, and that's the Chuck's Island, and that this would have been, is that the Presbyterian?
No. My mother told me that up where the old clinic is, and you look at the plat, when I was mayor of Kilowog, I researched this, the plat. The oldest plat that they have shows the clinic area used to be a school. That was the school ground, I forget what it was called on there. But that's where that building is. That's up where the old clinic is.
Okay.
Yeah.
So where do you think this cannery and what this part of Kilowog is?
This is what stumps me, though. That would be the... Oh, okay, this is taken from the mouth of the creek. Mouth of the Kilowog Creek. And this is that flats that comes out. Okay. I'm still right. That's up where that clinic is. Yeah. And this would be outward. The bridge would be over here now. Yeah. I guess that... The other thing I asked Scooter to do was have that same picture reversed and see if that makes a difference as far as recognizability. Because I'm having a hard time with all these houses here. But maybe there was houses there way before I could remember them.
He showed us a picture that was very similar to this, and a very similar view, only in his picture, this building isn't here, it's trees, and there's not so many houses, it's not as built up. So his picture must be before this one.
Okay. But that makes sense, though. This would be out toward where the bridge is.
Yeah.
And I say it again. It's the only place that would be deep enough for boats to come in to unload.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I wanted to ask you a few more questions about Bayview Boulevard and where the material to build the road came from, and the dirt.
Mm-hmm. It would have to have come off the island here, because there was no bridge then, and there was no what we call the divide over on this side. The Tlaloc was literally an island. So the dirt could have come from almost anywhere, and especially by the fact that dirt had to be, my guess is it was brought in on scows and then hand wheelbarrowed up onto the road site. And there were no vehicles in Tlaloc then, or no dump trucks, backhoes.
There was nowhere to drive them.
Yeah.
Had you heard any stories about seine boats, the fishermen bringing road materials in on their boats?
No. Very likely, if a seine boat was used, it probably would have been to tow the scow in. These big fish scows. I don't know if you've ever seen any of those pictures. Mm-hmm. And that's my guess, is that the dirt was hauled in on those big fish scows. That's about the only way they could have done it.
So, was the Tlaloc area, do you know where town is now and Bayview Boulevard is now, was any of that area used during a seasonal round for shellfish collection or fish processing, or were people hauling boats up or making boats on the foreshore, anything like that, collecting eggs, any sort of subsistence activities right along this area that you can think about?
Not really, because subsistence-wise, it is ongoing year-round. You know, there was no, we were not a state then. And the state didn't tell us when we could go out and fish.
I should clarify. I don't mean subsistence and as a term that the state would use now. I mean, as people over time, did they come here to subsist?
Yeah.
What were those specific activities that they did, and did they do them?
Yeah, just the word itself is a trigger word. You know,
it is. I apologize.
But we gathered food year round. Depending on the time of the season. Early spring, as you know now, the herring come in. When the herring come in, everything comes in behind it. The whales, the seals, the porpoises, the salmon, everything comes in behind the herring. And then harvesting the roe, the herring roe, was a delicacy to us. And after the herring, now the king salmon come in. And for instance, if my father went out and got fish eggs, he'd bring it ashore right here, which we used to when I was a kid.
Just in front of the house
here?
Yeah,
we'd bring it right up, up on the beach, bring it in. And my father was a Haida. What they taught him was, your first catch, you just give it away. That means then you'll have better luck getting. And I used to see my dad give everything away, you know. But in fact, that's him there.
Hmm.
And same thing with salmon. Whenever we got a lot of salmon, everything came ashore right here on our beach. Then you look over there, you see somebody else working on fish on the beach. You look on this way, you see somebody working on. But that's just the way it was. You know, there was no stainless steel tables around for us to work on them. So you worked on them on the beach. And from early spring with king salmon into the full salmon run. Humpies, dog salmon, sockeye, and everything. And by then, everybody's working in the canneries. And after the cannery work is over, fall time, you know, we're back to getting some more dog salmon and cohos. And back then, everything we did to preserve our foods was put them in salt barrels. Again, we had no freezers and so on. But everything was put in salt barrels. We'd salt everything. And by the time that part of the fall is over, then we're into the deer season. And getting out hunting deer, you know, stocking up for the winter. Again, going into the salt barrels. Or a lot of times into the smokehouse. Same thing with the salmon. A lot of it got smoked in the smokehouse. And during the winter months, it is just whatever we could get out of the Tawak River. There'd be some cohos up into February. I remember we used to go up this 12-mile creek, I think they called it. I remember going up there with my dad and spearing cohos out of that small creek winter months. And during the winter months, you know, we're trapping mink, marten, land otter, trapping again for to make some money, and then tough it out through the winter, and pretty soon spring starts all over again. But wherever they worked on food, you know, primarily right near the beach. So.
And would that just be out in front of someone's home?
Pretty much, yeah. And I don't remember my parents doing any preparing of the fish or anything around the cannery areas. And it is always done on the beach, you know, just wherever. And quite honestly, when I think back on it, you know, just how unsanitary that could have been. You know, just when you think about it. Well, of course, people didn't think about those things back then. And berry picking, oh, that is always fun. A lot of berry picking. And not only salmon berries, blueberries, huckleberries, but we used to go up and pick swamp berries, what we call swamp berries. It's a cluster of about four clusters of, and they were delicious, but they were so hard to pick, you'd almost crawl around to pick them up there. And then the other one was what my mom used to call smiling berries. Some people call it sly berries, all kinds of different. But you get those in a, not so much the swamp, but on the edges of the swamp. We have these real stiff leaves. But I remember picking those with my mom and them. And again, you know, that's just everything that we did was preparing for the winter months. And the wild asparagus, I don't know if you're familiar with that.
Mm-hmm.
I remember going out after that, washing it, cleaning it, packing it, cooking it, storing it away in jars. That's about the only stuff we didn't salt. it was this wild asparagus. But other than that, you know, dry fish went in boxes, went up into the upstairs. The herring eggs on kelp, we would dry it in the sun and put it in the box, put it upstairs. It was like eating potato chips when we were kids, the herring eggs on kelp. You know. But you think about all these things that we grew up on. Now a lot of us think it's a treat, you know, and we get it at different functions. You know. I have to tell you this story. My real good friend, he was chairman of the board of Shaanxi Village Corporation. And him and I were going through the food line, and I got up to this great big pot, dipped in there, dipped it again. I called, "Hey, Bill," I said, "get back here." "Why, what's the matter now?" I said, "get back here." I said, "remember when we were kids, when our mothers would buy a package of wieners? There was not enough wieners to go around, so she'd cut them up and make gravy." "Yeah?" "Said, look at it, that's all that is." He dipped in there, "damn, you're right there." And I said, "look at the rest of this food here. They think it's a big treat, I don't know. That's all the stuff we grew up on." But I just laugh about it. I still say that when I'm going through the lines of the different functions. But our subsistence, and again, a white man word, it is hard work, but the way we were trained, and I could almost hear my mother telling my brother and I, it'll taste good wintertime. It's going to taste good wintertime. And after a while, you just didn't even complain about it because you knew that you were going to be eating it this winter. But that was something that I think is not really recorded, you know, of how we were trained, you know, to do these things.
Did most of those activities involve the entire family, or did
they? Definitely. Mm-hmm. Of course, my father was always away from us, so to speak, you know, on fishing boat or hunting boat, and when he was home, though, he would tend to do these things. Well, even the fall, I missed fall time during the big tides after the fishing season was over. They would get together, and one of the boats would take three or four or five guys out with them, and they'd harvest logs off the beach, logs that are drifting. They'd tow them in, then they'd divide them up. I remember 6-8 logs of ours down here on the beach, and that we would hope would carry us through the winter. But I remember my brother and I down the beach. I tell people, I spent half of my life down on that damn beach cutting wood when I was a kid. But again, it's just part of what we had to do.
And would that be a common sight along the beach?
Definitely.
To see people cutting up firewood?
Definitely, yeah. There were no chainsaws them days. In fact, we had a 7-foot, what they call falling saw, my brother and I. And we finally figured it out, because there were so many of us cousins that were going through this. We finally got together, say, okay, we're going to start down at Boggy and Hushy's. We go down there, 5, 6, 7 of us go down there, get 2 saws going, cut up their log, pack it up, chop it up, go over to Sam's house, cut up his logs, go over to Jimmy's, cut up his, come over to our house. We finally figured it out, instead of my brother and I by ourselves, you know. And literally turn into fun, you know, while we're doing that. Before we know it, we're done. And then we can go play. But there were people that were quite better off than us that owned what they call a drag saw. I don't know if you ever heard of such a piece of machinery. Mounted on the A-frame. And very heavy, very, very heavy. Then the saw was even heavier. But I remember Grandpa Isaac Atass had one. I used to just marvel. Whenever I heard it running, you could hear it almost all over town. Walk over there and watch that big, heavy sound. Just go right down that big log. You know. Then somebody else further down toward the cannery had one. And other than that, it is falling saw, hand saw. And by the time all this wood was cut up and burned, then we would have to go across the bridge. My brother and I go up and fall a tree, and cut the wood, pack it down to the road. We didn't have pickups or anything to haul it with. And my dad got a hold of a piece of corrugated roof tin, folded the corners up, put a rope on it, and that's what we used to haul our wood home on.
So you would drag that along the ground?
On the snow, yeah. And then the bay would freeze up, all the way from here down to the cannery would freeze.
Does it still freeze?
No, not anymore. Freeze thick enough that you can walk on it. I remember we used to walk on it, walk over to Canoe Pass, cut wood, drag it down on the ice, and drive nails in the blocks of wood, tie rope on it. My brother and I drag our wood across on ice.
Wow.
But that's why we were so husky when we were kids growing up, you know. And this, all this hard manual work was constant.
Can you tell me about the area around Sand Point and what activity used to go on there?
I've read, have you read the book, The Quoker Raven? That's a book you need to get your hands on.
Mm-hmm.
But we were told that that was where they used to burn bodies, in essence, cremate bodies, down on that point. And eventually, a group of people, stockholders, so to speak, formed the, oh, and what's the name of that? They formed a co-op and built that store.
When would they have been cremating people there?
Well, the book was written about 1928, and he talks about now both of these books are the same by the same author. He talks about cremating them. Okay, where are we? It would have been in the early 20s, I imagine, that they were still doing this. Here, page 220. I see pictures of my grandmother in here, too. My grandmother and my great-grandmother. Your name is Sarah, huh?
Mm-hmm.
That's my youngest granddaughter's name, Sarah. And she was named after my great-Tlingit grandmother, huh. Sarah Jackson. Okay, this talks about headstones already. But I remember reading in here, though, that maybe he mentions that that's where they used to burn bodies, off that point, off around Sandpoint.
But maybe that was before the Presbyterian Church or the influence came in? That story you're talking about, was that the Bureau of Education had helped set up that cooperative store? Is that the cooperative store at Sandpoint?
No. From what I read in this book, it was something that they initiated themselves.
The people of Kluwak?
Yeah, the stockholders.
Mm.
It wasn't everybody, though, but just a certain well-off families, I imagine, were stockholders in there. Even up to the time that it was no longer in operation, which was into the 60s, there were still families that claim that they are still stockholders of that. Because Al Woodmark and his wife offered it to Betty and I one time and wanted to sell it to us for $35,000. Of course, that is like $1 million back then. And very quickly, word came, got around that it was offered to Betty and I. So my uncles, different uncles, told me, you know, he said, better stay away from it. You know, it's still, stockholders still own it. So, turns out, you know, it's evaporated. It's gone now.
But that store operated until the 60s?
Yeah, right up to when Betty and I got married in 66, it was still operating.
What sort of things did they sell?
General store.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Dry goods, medicines, just everything. There were two stores. Al Woodmark had one and Frank Pradovich had one. They were right within, we were equivalent of a block apart. And then another cousin, Bob Pradovich, had another store. And Uncle Ed Pradovich had one here. So those, the four stores seemed to do well, though.
Where did they get their merchandise to sell?
from Seattle. Mm-hmm. Once a week, the mailboat would come in from Ketchikan, the Dart, when I was a kid. The name of the boat was the Dart. It would come in with mail and some groceries. And about once a month, the Silver Wave would come in with produce. And then there was one more boat that used to come in. But we were just kids, and we used to literally run down there in Longshore. And just to tell you that all my labor relations background is already starting. We convinced, I don't know whether it was Frank or Al Woodmark, but we convinced one of them, hey, the other guy's paying us, because we were getting 50 cents an hour. And that's hard work for kids. And we told him, yeah, the other guy's paying us 75 cents an hour. I think 75 cents. Oh, is that right? Yeah. So we go down and tell the other guy, yeah, he's paying us 70, offered us 75. Then we did get our 75 cents an hour. But I'm guessing, though, that they saw right through us, though. We were just hard-working kids, though. We worked any kind of work that we could fit into, we took it. So.
Do you remember any of the other buildings that were along Bayview Boulevard, like the theater or the pool hall or those sorts of buildings? Can you tell me about those?
Yeah, right out here. In fact, I was talking to Raymond Roberts over in Ketchikan, right off the point out here.
Just in front of your house?
No, over below where Fanny's house is. I remember the Peter Roberts had a boat shop there. And then...
Was he building boats for fishermen or for the cannery or...
Boat shops. They built rowboat skiffs and so on.
Oh, so for people who... anybody who wanted one in Kluwak just to get around.
Then I remember there was another one past Sandpoint store, past Cato, right? Just past where the school is. On the beach side, there was another boat shop there that is Armors. And then further down toward the cannery, right at where that sharp corner turns, where you see some machinery rusting on the beach. Right in that corner there was another boat shop there, and that's where the Billy and I was built. And
which boat was the Billy and I?
She's up on the gridiron now, or up on whatever they call it, where they park the boats now. But it is built by the Demerits. Quite a story on it. The oldest son had two sons, Bill Doom Jr. and Leroy. Leroy was the youngest brother. And he was just after them. What are you going to name the boat? What are you going to name the boat? What are you going to name the boat? Why don't you name it Billy and I? He meant Billy and Leroy. Name it Billy and I. That's how the boat name came about. Billy and I. then another story about Leroy again. He had a little skiff turned upside down by the house, and he painting the name on it, Billy and I. Then he turned the boat over here, the name was on upside down. Another story of Leroy. But Leroy, the two brothers actually went on to become educators. Bill became a doctorate. There's quite a story about them. But that's where the boat was built. And I remember when they launched the Billy and I. I remember that.
How big of a boat is the Billy and I?
58 footer. It's still alive. When you're going to Craig, as if you're going out to Petro, you'll see a boat yard off to the left. And you'll see a bunch of boats on the right side first. Slow down when you make that turn, then you'll look right up at the Billy and I.
And they built that on...
They built it right down here.
And launched it off the beach into the water here.
Yeah.
Wow, did you see the launching?
It seems to me I did, but I was just a little fella then. Probably just getting to the age where I was chasing girls or something.
But they were building really big boats here.
Oh, yeah. There's Several boats were built here in Tlaloc. And Tlaloc had a reputation of having boat builders. They're quite the builders. And I don't remember exactly who they were, but there's quite a few boats. J.H. Coombs was built here. Rex was built here. Billy and I was built here. Seems to me somebody said that the Diamond Sea was built here. There's quite a few boats built here.
So they were building small boats for people in and around the area, but would these big boats would have been fishing?
Seiners.
Yes.
Yeah. But yeah, there were quite a few boats built here, and I've always heard stories of how Tlaloc was known for boat builders.
And do you remember the other buildings, such as the pool hall or the movie theater, when those were being used, when those were built? And
the first pool hall that I remember was right down here. My uncle owned this one after he came home from World War II. He bought a building right down here and put pool tables in it.
Is that just in front of your house here on the...
Just off to the left of my property.
Okay.
And then the bowling alley was built by the Woods brothers, Leo, George, and Frank Woods, probably their father too. And that one opened about 1952. And that had two alleys, bowling alleys, and had about, I think, two or three pool tables. But I remember by the time I was in high school, we used to go down there and bowl and play pool.
Were those buildings popular with people from around the area, like Craig, or did people come from other parts outside of Tlaloc to come to the
Mainly
pool hall?
Mainly Craig and Tlaloc, because Heidelberg was not connected yet, except during the summer months when the fleets, when this place used to be just like the Wild West summertime. You'd get the Tlaloc fleet, two cannery fleets, Craig Libby fleet, Waterfall New England fleet, Steamboat Bay fleet, and then Puget Sound fleet. Puget Sound boats would come up here. And then Hoonah, Angoon, Wrangell, Petersburg fleet would come down. You're looking at hundreds and hundreds of fishermen coming into Craig Tlaloc area. But literally, it is like the Wild West. Just fights all over up and down the street.
Wow, so they would deliver their fish to the canneries here?
Well, there was a cannery in Steamboat Bay. There was a cannery in Craig. There were two canneries in Craig. The Libby cannery in Craig was what they call a two-line cannery. And then there was the Linenberger cannery in Craig. And then there was Bob Pradovich's cannery here. And then the Libby cannery here in Tlaloc. Than Waterfall Cannery. But yeah, the fleets were huge then. There was a lot of boats here then, a lot of crew. But
what month did they come?
August, mostly in August.
And how long would they stay?
Probably about 2 weeks. By 2 weeks, and the fishing would drop off outside. When we say outside, we mean Cape Addington, Granite Point, you know, and the boats would come fish inside. By then, Wrangell, Petersburg, Sitka boats would go back, and then the Puget Sound boats would go back, so that would leave Heidelberg, Waterfall, Craig Tlaloc boats. But by then, a lot of the local captain starting to realize, hey, we can make more money, just as much money. Go down to Puget Sound. Excuse me, let me get that. So anyway, everybody would leave, and we kind of regroup, and then fall season would start. Fall season was usually either around here, and then Chomley would open up. around, it's on the east side of Prince of Wales Island. So we'd run over there, and then pretty soon we started running up up by Huna. Yeah. Name escapes me at the moment. Not Chatham. But anyway, that second season would be up north again. And pretty soon, fishing game stopped, fall fishing. So now just sporadically we have fall fishing over in Cholmondeley maybe. But by then again, like I was saying earlier, things started winding down. All the seines would be put away, the boats would be winterized. And we go into the winter months of gathering food.
When would the cannery workers come to work here?
They probably start arriving in June. Around the first part of June, they started getting the canneries ready and getting the boats ready. And it's June, July, August, probably end of August, everybody would head back. A lot of, in the old days, I'm told that they used to use a lot of Chinese labor. And by the time I came around, then mostly Filipinos. You know, both Craig Tlawak canneries, were a lot of Filipinos were working. And that seemed to be the case all up and down southeast, because now you see a lot of families half Filipino, the fathers are Filipino. And here in Tlawak, there's only one family, two families that were half Tlingit, half Filipino.
Did the cannery workers mostly stay in cannery bunk houses, or did they stay in, did they rent houses around town?
No, they had bunk houses for them, yeah.
And so did they mix with the local?
Not a whole lot. Not a whole lot. Maybe on weekends, but not a whole lot. I don't remember seeing them mix very much. So.
Summer here.
To say the least, it was. Not only are we dancing as fast as we can for subsistence, but then working in the canneries. I remember the first year I went to work in the cannery. Actually, let me back up. First time I was 8 years old when I first went out on a seine boat. 8 years old. I was looking at one of my grandsons not too long ago, and I said, "You're 8 years old?" He said, "Yeah." I told him that's the age I was when I was on a seine boat. By the time I was 9, turning 10, I was out at Cape Addington fishing with my uncle on Cape Addington, out on the outside. And ever since then, just every year. But by the time we got up into high school, a lot of our earnings went to our school years. And then when we got sent away to Mount Edgecombe, of course, you know, that money went with us to Mount Edgecombe boarding school, then down to Kansas. So it was spring and summer months was exciting. We'd come home from Mount Edgecombe, get off the plane. The next day we were literally down at the cannery working. Just no rest.
Boys and girls?
Mostly the boys, mostly the guys, because we're doing a lot of manual work, getting the cannery ready and down on the beach gang, and then, you know, working on getting the cannery ready and cleaning up. And so it was mostly the guys.
What did the girls do?
Nothing.
Oh.
I grew up with five sisters, so I know that. walk around trying to act cute.
Now, the cannery... Did the fishermen own the boats, or did the canneries have the fishermen use their boats?
Some of the skippers owned their own boats, and some of them ran a boat that was owned by the cannery. And eventually, the Bureau of Indian Affairs came in again and established boat loans. and the guys were able to get a boat loan. And I remember when all these boats were coming into the Tlahuac, I can almost remember all the names too, of the boats that were bought under the BIA. And unfortunately, that program was abused in the sense that a lot of them didn't make payments. So the boats were taken back, taken away from them, passed on to somebody else, pretty soon the boats were gone.
The boats that the cannery owned, what would happen to those after the fishing season?
They get stored. In fact, I remember there was gridirons right down here when I was a kid. They would put them on gridiron down here for the winter.
Just down on the beach?
Yeah.
About how many boats would be stored down there?
There's a picture of Bob's Cannery, and I wish I remember who has that picture now. There was, gosh, he looked like he had about 15, 20 boats. But some of those would be taken south, or maybe to Wrangell for repairs. And they would take them south, get them overhauled, clean them up, and then they'd bring them back spring months.
The boat builders here in town didn't do the repair work?
By the time I came around, by the time I was a young teenager, there were no more boat builders. Other than the Billy and I that I remember was the last boat launched. Mm. After that, there were just no more boats built. Well, there was. They weren't exactly built, but they were rebuilt. There was a couple boats pulled up on the marineways down at the cannery, and they would tear off the cabins and rebuild the cabins. That's about all.
Now, you mentioned to me at the beginning about when you were little and being underneath the boardwalk and looking for things people dropped. Can you describe how extensive the boardwalks were through the village?
Oh gosh, all the way down from the end of the road, down past Uncle Ed's house, all the way around Bayview Boulevard here, around by the A&B Hall, turned down toward past Sandpoint Store, all the way down to the cannery.
So essentially, the road out from the cannery all along Bayview Boulevard out to the stop sign
down,
with the...
All the way down toward the end of the road, what we call mm-hmm. end of the road. That, again, before the road highway was built. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And...
How about going up into... up the hill?
Off Bayview Boulevard was mainly boardwalks, sidewalks. There were no streets parallel with Bayview Boulevard. There still aren't, except in the new housing areas now.
And what was the ground like underneath the boardwalks that you can remember underneath Bayview Boulevard?
It wasn't really muddy. It was almost much like just a beach.
With rocks and...
Yeah, because the tide would come up under there and wash it out, come up and wash it out, so... Wouldn't wash out our money, though. Even a nickel, boy, was a lot of money to us guys back then.
And how often were those boardwalks, did they have to be repaired? Do you remember?
Pretty much constantly. You know, whenever a plank would break through, I remember somebody replacing them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This road that's called Mance Street,
yeah.
Just down here?
Yeah.
That used to go up to the Presbyterian Church in Mance?
Correct.
Do you think that was a boardwalk previously, that road?
Not that I remember. It was always a dirt road.
So this picture shows a boardwalk going up the hill with tracks on it. And I was wondering if this was the Presbyterian manse being built, because they talk about, the Presbyterian Yearly Journal talks about building a boardwalk with rails on it.
That's got to be it then. This would have been George Roberts' house.
The building down in front.
Yeah, I remember that corner. Yeah, that would have to be the Mint Street. Yeah.
So when we were looking at these pictures yesterday, Leslie was figuring that this was the end of Chuck's Island, that little point there, and how I show you that other picture would have been taken.
Chuck's Island would be over this way.
So you think that this is actually where the bridge is?
Yeah. Again, that's the deepest spot in that area that would house those boats that came in there.
Mm-hmm.
Anywhere else would be too shallow for those size boats to get in there.
What's it like right off of Chuck's Island?
All the way around from the back side or front side is just gradual slope.
Mm-hmm.
But over where the bridge is drops down.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can you talk about the names of, you told me before that it was like little districts in Klowok and each area was its own little place. Can you tell me about how places were named? Like how is Chuck's Island, Chuck's Island? And
I wasn't alive yet when anyone's living on Chuck's Island. But what I understand of it, though, that island belonged to the family by the name of Chuck, last name Chuck. And again, over on this side, the island, my cousin was on it, came up with that name, the Island Kids. And Amelia McAlpin over in Ketchikan, she's a 1955 graduate of Klowok, last graduating class from Klowok. I listened to her talk about it more than once, and almost like she was offended by that name. But I always thought it was just a cute name, that, you know, the Island Kids. And I could pretty much tell you the families that lived over there. The Williams, the Jacksons, the Kings, the Kidas, Browns, Charles, Martinez and Dix. Those were families that lived on that island. And by the time we got over on this side, Uncle Edward and them were down the end. Uncle Richard Carl, Ashdowns, Salvation Army, McNeils. And there was a Filipino family, Roxy something. And Darrow's down on the waterside. Peter Adams. Came around the corner was my Aunt Jenny. Her house is still there. Original house, the big yellow one. And then Grandpa Jim Pradovich, Uncle Johnny Pradovich, then our house. And then Donald Roberts, my Aunt Rosanna Roberts. And then right below them would be George Roberts, that house I showed you.
Oh.
Peter Keene's house. But it is literally almost divided up into little districts, you know. For instance, if we're going to play baseball or play basketball or tug of war, you almost selected the kids in your area.
Yeah. Maybe if you don't mind, we could. I brought these images that I showed you before, maybe we can find an older one, and I've got some markers, and we can write, if you can recognize the house or even the area, we can write the name of who lived in that spot. Would that be? This one is from 1965, and it's going to be the oldest, apart from 1926, that's going to be the oldest aerial photograph that we have.
It's erasable off here, huh? You can erase this off.
I can get one that will erase off here.
What is a magic marker? Water. Okay, this is what we call the island.
Mm-hmm.
The Island Kids. Because the boardwalk used to come through here. And all this... See, this here is a pond.
Okay. That's great.
There's a pond there, and a wooden bridge used to come across there during the wooden days. Then it would turn, and right... Again, as I was saying, right in this area here is a pond. I remember when it froze up, I remember we used to skate in there. And right in this area here was a wooden bridge. And this whole area here was what we called the pond, the island kids. This is where my grandparents and my great-grandparents lived on this island. Charles is over in this area, Jack Brown, Coquelin's, Keita's, King's, Williams, and right here were this three-pronged areas, what we call Busy Corner Store. My uncle Ed Pradovich had a store here, which became the post office. Right next to him was Russell's Place Confectionery, and this one here would have been... That might have been Russell's place there. And this one here was Nick Pradovich's house. And this one here was Auntie Jenny's, and that house is still there. She used to have the most beautiful garden. And this one here is Jim Pradovich. That house is next door to me. And this one is Isaac's house here. We'll be darned. And then it swings around. And this would have been this is Mance Street here. The first church was right here where it burned down 1954. And this was the Mance, and this was the new Presbyterian church that I helped build when I came home from school. This is Auntie Rosanna's house. And this one here was Peter Keene's house. This was the old theater. And Robert Pradovich's house, and that's still there. Bob Pradovich's house, and that's gone. Uncle David Pradovich's house here. And... see... Joseph's house, Thompson Pradovich's house, and I think this one was converted into a church by then. And this is Grandma Elizabeth's house, and there's the A&B hall, and Bob Pradovich's store, old City Hall, and this would have been Albert Brown's house, and this would have been the old bunkhouse, Filipino bunkhouse, Uncle Frank's store, and the old mess hall from Bob's Cannery, what's left of Bob's Cannery, Uncle Frank's garage, and Jumbo McPhee's house, Robert George's house, Emma Watson's house, George Demert's house, Sandpoint store, and Sandpoint dock. Used to be a dock all the way out there. And this house is still there. That green house by the float.
Mm-hmm.
It's still there. And Cato's house, still there. Of course, there's the school. And right about here is where the original school was that burnt down.
The BIA school?
Yeah. And this was Lonesome, you can call him, his house. This was the totem carving shed. And this would have been the armor's house, Charlie Grant's house, George Johnson's house, Jimmy Johnson's house, the Roans, I think that was David Demmert's house. And Bob Smith. Where the hell is Bob Smith's house? It must have been torn down. Okay, this would have been the sawmill. That's the one of the books say that it's a cannery. And this was the bowling alley. And smokehouse.
The sawmill was not part of a cannery and not a cannery. It was just
independent.
A sawmill.
No, independent. Mm-hmm. Spencer Williams' house, George Wood's house. Somewhere in there was Grandpa Charlie Williams' house, right about here. And just empty lot where they stored lumber. And right about here was where that boat shed was that the Billy Nye was built in. And right about here was where that other boat shed was. And seemed like Raymond Roberts told me they had a boat shed here. And the armors. Okay, where am I? Armors had one boat shed right around here somewhere.
So by 1965, none of those boat sheds...
They were all gone now.
...are there.
Yeah. Armors, Hollywood's, McNeil's should have been right there, yeah. Anisket's. Charlie Demmert's big house, city dock or city float, or fuel dock, yeah. And bunkhouse.
That's great.
The other thing, I was talking to another friend of mine, him and I pretty much grew up here together, but I told him, you know, I could just about remember where every cottonwood tree was when I was a kid.
Why is that?
I don't know. They were just such huge trees. And now there's two of them on my property over by the bridge. But the fall time, when the leaves were falling, remember how big the leaves would get? Remember, we used to collect them so you could find the biggest cottonwood tree. We didn't even know the name of the tree then, though. But we used to collect them so you could find the biggest leaf. Simple things we used to turn into entertainment.
Do you remember there being many trees around the village when you were growing up?
Yeah. Oh, somewhere. Seems like it's somewhere around here. What we call a bomb shelter. There was a building back there. Looked like we used to call it a bomb shelter.
Why did you call it a bomb shelter and when do you think
know.
It was built?
I don't know. Remember now, I was growing up during World War II. But I remember going back there. We used to steal chicken eggs from Charlie Demmert's house and go up there. End up stealing rotten eggs. So.
And when you were going up there, did that look like it had been used, or was it?
It is just a
falling?
Great big one, big room, almost like these steel buildings you see now, just open, and all kinds of debris in there. Not so much debris, but extracurricular